Thundergrunt.
Bob.
Let's introduce ourselves.
I am Jimmy George. I am a full-time script consultant and a screenwriter occasionally.
I am Jamie Nash, screenwriter and screenwriting podcaster.
And I'm Bob Rose. I'm a filmmaker, a podcaster, and later in life, I've learned that I really love sushi.
Really? Later in life?
Yeah, I didn't so much before.
You're scared of the raw stuff, and then you realize it's not all raw, and then you dabbled, and now you do raw, too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It, like, the gateway is cream cheese.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Like, you know, because, like, they have the sushi rolls with cream cheese in them, and then you're like, well, I love cream cheese.
I've never had a sushi roll with cream
really?
Cheese.
Really? It's pretty prevalent now, man.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, that's more of an American thing, I think.
I'm kind of a giant sushi kind of guy, like a supermarket sushi. I don't
know. You guys seen the sushi burritos?
Oh, God. Well, this is a weird podcast. Yeah. Okay.
So today we're doing Jiro Loves Sushi. Or what was that?
Dreams of Sushi. That's an awesome documentary. Yeah, I love that documentary.
It's a good one.
We're going to talk about, which I have no fear in saying, is the best Tim Allen movie.
My favorite role of his.
I mean,
sure.
Right. I mean, like Santa Claus may be right under it. But we're going to talk about Galaxy Quest.
Galaxy Quest.
Right?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out. I'm thinking through Tim Allen's The Stump. Like, there must be.
I just repeated you like you were the computer in Galaxy Quest.
Right? No, it's perfect. Yeah. So unless you can think of a better one, Jamie, I don't know.
Can't. I was trying to find. What was the off the beaten path one where it was kind of a drama and it was a crime movie?
He's done some big recently.
Big Trouble.
That's been
big Trouble. That was the one
different.
I still like Galaxy Quest more. Yeah.
I just was trying to figure one out.
Yeah. Okay. We're gonna. Talk about
Toy Story.
Yeah, Buzz Lightyear.
I don't consider that a Tim Allen movie. Uh-huh. I don't know.
It's funny, the Buzz Lightyear and the Commander, they're very similar in their...
There's a play.
Know,
there's a little
yeah,
bit of a play off
exactly,
of there.
Yeah.
Toy Story.
I still don't consider that like a Tim Allen movie. Though.
Okay.
Do you guys? I don't think so. It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
I cannot
the best
see.
Live action Tim Allen role.
There we go.
How's that?
Okay. Okay.
How's that?
We'll let it pass.
Yeah. And Joe somebody. Anyway. We're going to talk about Galaxy Quest. Jamie, is it a blockbuster? What did it make? What did it cost?
Let me tell you what it cost. I know this.
off the top of my head. No research.
Encyclopedic knowledge.
Ignore that box office mojo behind the curtain. It made $71 million.
Wow.
Domestically.
2000?
99, I believe.
It was. Where is that on my box office mojo? I do not see it.
It
1999.
Okay,
I was right.
Ah, Bob.
I was right.
December 25th, 1999. Ooh. Christmas.
This
Day.
Is like the most barely 90s movie you get.
Yeah.
Right?
So it on a budget of $45 million, according to Mojo, and didn't make much in the foreign sales, only $19 million, which is kind of what happens with comedies and spoofs and things like that. So, also back then, maybe, you know, the foreign market wasn't as huge in play as it is now.
So it made money.
It made money. It almost made 100. I mean, and I remember in the 90s, people were going apeshit over $100 million.
I'd say, yeah, absolutely. Like $100 million was pretty rare.
Used to be
then.
The big benchmark.
If you got there, you were a big hit.
Yeah.
So, also you have to remember that VHS and DVDs were in play back then, that they made almost twice as much money there back then, where now it's not that way at all.
Yeah.
So, they probably racked in the bucks on VHS and DVD.
I think before we talk about the script, the important thing to talk about with this movie specifically is the development. There's a lot of stories about Galaxy Quest, especially for a movie that's so beloved and turned out so great. I'm going to speak for you guys. It's got actually a pretty rocky history.
I don't know this.
It started out as a spec script
called
Captain Starshine.
What a great title.
Jeez.
Yeah, exactly. It's the best title. It was originally a spec script that sold, I don't know when it sold,
When's not that important, though.
Yeah.
No, I was looking this up the other day because I didn't actually know it. Hold on one second. Let me adjust. But then it was rewritten afterwards. And as I think we were talking about, it had some interesting original director.
Oh, yeah. So it was originally, if you didn't know, I originally read this in EW Magazine about how Harold Ramis was supposed to direct this.
Man.
And then later on, back in the old golden years of Ain't It Cool News, I remember reading about Harold Ramis left the project specifically because he didn't want to work with Tim Allen.
That's right.
Wow.
Which I guess says a lot about how he viewed Tim Allen's brand of comedy. But then again, I think in retrospect, Tim Allen, what he didn't like about Tim Allen worked for this movie.
Absolutely. His bravado.
Yeah, right. Like, Harold Ramis is a comedy god to me. I would never disparage, him in any way. But in this case, I think that history was on the right side.
I agree.
Everything that happened.
And his original, the guy he really wanted to play was Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
Who I heard.
Which also might have been interesting.
I could see that totally working, Alec Baldwin. Yeah.
He just has that same arrogance about him.
And what? In that time, was he really doing these 30 Rock type things? And you see he stretches those muscles later in
post
30
Rock, that would have been an absolute, the studio would have went right with it.
Yeah. And I've heard other people came and went in the casting department. I don't remember who exactly they were, but there were other people. And then once Tim Allen came on board, he left. They brought in a guy that I really don't even know his career that well. Dean Pariseau?
Going to be the director of Bill and Ted 3 if it ever happens.
Really?
Yes. He's been confirmed by Alex Winter several times over. I'm actually excited. I think
that's
a great choice.
Yeah.
Right.
Bill and Ted Face the Music will be...
Well, directed by Galaxy
it's
Quest.
Pre-production. Mainly the things he's done recently are television. Lots of episodic television. He did Red 2 since then.
He did Red 1 too, I thought, didn't he?
I'm going in.
Are you in reverse order?
I don't see Red 1.
Okay, maybe he just did 2.
I kind of remember.
Did he do like Dick and Jane,
Fun with Dick and Jane.
Yeah.
And most of the other stuff is TV stuff after that. I mean, and good.
Galaxy Quest is his claim to fame.
Yeah, big TV stuff. I mean, he's definitely been in business ever since.
Yeah.
So he's not. Funny thing, a bunch of Monk episodes, so he reworked with
Tony Shalhoub.
Tony Shalhoub.
Also notable with the development of this is that at one point, I can't remember if it was with the script, with early development with the script, but it was discussed that they were actually going to get the crew of the original Star Trek and make this a meta parody with William Shatner and
Freddy's New Nightmare or something
Freddy. Which I think they made the right decision, but that is really interesting.
Can you imagine
if they just did it with Star Trek? That would be, and if it was successfully
Leonard
executed,
Nimoy being like depressed and like,
you're right,
like the Alan Rickman role, like being,
but
like,
when you look at the movie and how it's written, like you could pop them in.
Yeah.
Directly.
Oh, dude, Grab Thar's Hammer could be Live Long and Prosper.
No, it's like directly a mirror of it.
This movie definitely was a what if for that situation. Because if you looked at Kirk and he was in that get a life mode, you had, Spock always kind of weighed heavy on him, whether or not it was serious work or whatever. He always kind of took it too seriously. The one thing I do like about Galaxy Quest, though, it kind of mixed Next Generation with the original series so that it blended it up enough that they weren't 100% analogous to the original.
Oh, yeah, it's not 60s. Like the historical documents are not from the 60s.
There's kind of a Wesley Crusher character.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Right. Tommy.
Yeah. And I'd say even Sigourney's character might feel a little bit more from Next Generation than Nora. So I kind of like the way they mixed them.
It's interesting. It works better because it didn't have to be laborious towards the source.
Yeah.
But what an interesting idea, though.
Oh, my God.
What a weird idea.
That could be so interesting.
Shatner making fun of himself would have been.
Yeah, it would have been awesome.
Right.
And later, I guess he did that with Free Enterprise.
Right. That's a movie that's kind of okay. It's like
nobody's ever seen it.
I've seen it several times. Yeah. It's like kind of a crappy Swingers, but with him, with guys that worship William Shatner.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like really odd.
Okay.
Anyway.
So the spec screenplay was written by a guy named David Howard, who really didn't do much after that. I mean, knowing the way Hollywood works, when I say he didn't do anything, he probably has a boat, a yacht, and, you know, has a big pool and worked on a million movies that he didn't get credit for.
Just uncredited.
Yeah, I'm sure he had a career. Well, I hope he had a career. And then it was rewritten by a guy named Robert Gordon, who Robert Gordon I met at the Austin Film Festival circa 2003 or something like that. And he was the coolest guy I ever met. And I wanted to be this guy because he was a guy who my wife and I were sitting there at a bar, the Driscoll, if you ever go to the Austin Film Festival. And he walked up next to us and bought us a drink and just started chatting it up.
Wow.
Like, hey, did he have a Galaxy Quest shirt on?
He did. I don't even think it was really him. It was some other guy pretending to be.
I'm Robert Gordon.
So ever since, he was like my idol. It was like he wrote the movie I wanted to write. He was a cool down-to-earth guy.
Okay.
He was a cool down-to-earth guy. He just seemed like a normal, very chill kind of guy. And so anyway, Robert Gordon rewrote David Howard's script. And reviewing some interviews for this podcast, I noticed that if you look at Robert Gordon, he says he never read Captain Starshine. He said, I never read it. He said, I never saw the script. I just wrote, you know, my rewrite was based on notes or whatever.
What?
And he worked, you know, for the original director back in the Alec Baldwin days, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a credit on the script. Now, that said, I read that interview where he said he never saw the Captain Starshine script and they changed it massively. However, David Howard did get both story by and screenplay credit. So whatever he wrote had to have a lot in common.
Right. It influenced it. It had to have.
Maybe
they're just really good notes.
It could be. He got the director notes and the director laid out the whole thing and said, this is kind of what we want. And they had a lot of conversations. And then it turned out to be a lot like the original screenplay, but he just never read it. You know?
Very possible.
Okay.
So there you go.
I don't want to derail it, but I'd love to pick your brain about that whole aspect of being a professional writer. I mean, do you experience that a lot where someone, either you're hired to rewrite somebody's script and you don't let the original material influence it whatsoever, or someone has rewritten your script and erases every word? Does that happen to you?
Is it common is what you're asking?
Yeah. Yeah.
I personally, and it's probably just because I don't have that level of success, had the second part happen where somebody completely rewrote me. Yeah. I have completely rewritten other people in the course of development. Like I have been hired to do that. I'll usually look at their script at some point, and I certainly won't do that thing where I'm changing names or doing stuff just to change it. I'm actually just the opposite. I'd love to. I tend to go back to the original at some point to steal good ideas, even if it's just lines of dialogues or gags or a good midpoint. I tend to like to do that. But what I usually try to do, if I can, I try not to read it at first. I try to come up with all my ideas, and then I go back and steal from their ideas, because it depends on the situation.
See which one's better.
Yeah. The reason I brought it up is because I think it's something that a lot of writers who are aspiring to do this don't understand, and it was a shock to me. Even it's happened to me where I've optioned a script, and then somebody with more power and influence and career rewrites it.
Yeah,
and they erase every word. Like it's only shares concept alone and title alone, but like there's nothing, there's absolutely nothing left from the original version.
I've probably done that to somebody once or twice.
Damn, like, you, Jamie.
Yeah, I probably have. But only on direction. I mean, it's not my choice. Like usually that's, we want a page one rewrite. We're hiring you.
You're directed by the producers. Absolutely.
I've also come in on the opposite of that and done a ton of work on somebody else's screenplay and gotten no credit because I came in the end. I basically kept their characters. I kept the locations. I kept the beats. I worked for 2 solid months. I did everything I was asked. I made the movie better. Lots of my stuff's in there. I get no credit.
So just the paycheck.
Just the paycheck. So that happens too.
So that's good more to know often than not. For anyone listening out there, I mean, that's a normal part of the screenwriting process in this day and age.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's a lot to do with Galaxy Quest too. Yeah. It happened with Galaxy Quest. And the talking about only keeping the concept is a great segue into us talking about concept.
The concept!
Like talking about this concept, what would you guys categorize the script as? Is it a satire, homage, parody?
Yeah, I was thinking about this.
It's a good question, right?
Yeah, I know it is.
Because it definitely has parody elements, and it has jokes and humor that you would only necessarily get if you got the other thing. Some, not all, just touches here and there.
Yeah, I think I think it's just like Shrek. Screp.
It's just like Three Amigos and Tropic Thunder. Yeah. That's what it's just like.
But
the third part of the trilogy.
You know, it's the perfect trilogy. Yeah.
That's a good point.
By the way, did you write that part? Yeah.
No, I totally wrote that.
Okay.
Because I view this as the perfect trilogy of this concept.
This was the second.
Western sci-fi.
This
and
was the
war.
Second thing you wrote in our outline that I thought I wrote.
If you listen to the last episode, that's what we're referring to.
It's
right.
So bizarre.
Would you have written that down?
No, I was going to write that
down. That's
perfect.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's perfect.
It was so weird.
Yeah. Well, because I always
think I had one more in there too.
Is there another that's this concept?
I think there was, and I can't remember. And then I was racking my brains trying to think what the third one I was going to write, and I couldn't remember.
I think Shrek is a satire of fairy tales and a fairy tale in itself. Describe that,
you mean
tonally.
I was more talking about like the concept, but you're talking about like tonally.
I would call this a satire of space adventure movie. And it's a space adventure movie in itself at the same time.
So it's also very pointed, though. It's not just genre pointed. It's pointed at Star Trek.
So I don't know where I picked this up, but I remember hearing one time the difference between parody and satire.
I have a tough time with that.
So parody, I've heard, comes at it with love, and satire comes at it with anger. That's what I've heard. Have you heard something else?
I've heard something.
So this would
be
a parody, then.
This would be a parody.
This is in love.
All satire is a complete indictment.
A lot of the Mel Brooks stuff is parody because it comes at it with love. Okay. Though I think you'd categorize like Blazing Saddles might be satire because it comes at the society or the general situation with a bit of anger. It has a grudge, you know.
So Scream would be parody then.
Scream or Scary Movie?
No, I mean Scream is kind of like a deconstruction of slasher movies.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know if it is the same because I don't know if it crosses the line.
So
Scary Movie is.
You're talking almost like the literary definition of those two words. Yes. Whereas to me, I know. Let me try to get these words out properly. When I hear parody and I think of film in general, what do you think of? What's the best?
Airplane.
Right. Yeah. And to me, like when I think of parody and movie in the same sentence, I think of movies that don't where the jokes exist in a different world than the actual narrative.
Yes.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
I know what you mean.
Right. So like it's weird. I know you're saying the literary definition, but when I think of a parody movie, I think of Airplane or Naked Gun or Suffer or things that can happen for the joke, and it doesn't matter about reality.
I'm going to throw a third term at you.
Go for it.
I think this movie, from the definition, there's literary definitions, which I did not invent. I've read them in a book somewhere.
Yeah.
Maybe a pastiche.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was waiting for somebody to bring it up.
Yeah. Okay, because like, I...
What's the definition of pastiche, real quick?
Oh, God. Why you got to put me on the spot?
Shit, I'm sorry.
Now I got to Google it. Pretend like
I'm
knew
having
it.
A problem with this discussion is my brain does not... paired these movies whatsoever with a Mel Brooks because
it doesn't.
Those movies are self aware. I don't think this movie's self aware.
No, I think all the jokes and the gags come from the narrative and they're not outside of the reality of the movie. I was not saying it's a parody. Gotcha. I'm just saying when he says that, I'm saying that's what Galaxy Quest isn't.
Okay,
it's like Hot Fuzz.
Right. Yes,
Hot
exactly. Post.
Everything Edgar Wright does, Galaxy Quest does. Yes. Galaxy Quest
that's
is like, if
perfect.
Edgar Wright made a sci-fi movie with more crash zooms.
So,
with less crash zooms,
but
sorry.
A pastiche, I think it's an imitation of or something.
Okay.
That's what it's doing.
That's good.
Yeah, Jimmy, I didn't want you to think I was saying this was a parody.
Oh, no.
This
so
is
I,
not like Airplane.
What I'm saying is like, I don't know how to conceptualize... Like, I have a hard time differentiating those terms and, like, putting my finger on what
you know, they're
mean.
Not that important of terms. Like,
how does it help
you in your real life
right,
if you call it satire or parody?
I wanted to talk about it because the movie is meta as this. Like, I feel like it's important to...
Well, no, and people write meta stuff all the time. Like, I read stuff where, you know, people are saying groovy in, like, a horror comedy.
Right.
And I'm like, you can't do that. You can say your own version of groovy, but if you say groovy,
saucy.
Then you're just becoming a horror, Mel Brooks horror. You know what I mean? So there is a fine line you walk with these types of
movies. I think
movies.
It's good. I think you're right. I think it's good to be aware so you're not crossing from one to the
There's
other.
There's a line.
What Galaxy Quest doesn't do that stuff like Mel Brooks and the Abrams and all that do, it's almost like a musical. like diegetic music versus non-diegetic music,
yes.
where the jokes are like almost non-diegetic. Mm-hmm. The characters can see the fourth wall. They make jokes outside of the narrative, right. outside of the reality. You know,
in the Mel Brooks, yeah.
In Mel Brooks, right. Yeah. Whereas in Galaxy Quest, none of that happens. No. It's not that type of
none movie. Of them know they're right. in a movie. Not
Which
for
I think
a second.
And I see people talk about these types of movies all the time and they don't understand this stuff. They'll
not
call
at all.
Galaxy Quest a parody. I'm like, it's not
right,
a parody.
Right. Yeah.
It is a self-contained narrative where everything that happens is explained.
What is Deadpool?
Oh, Deadpool
parody.
Is parody, yeah.
Okay. That's a good question because the character of Deadpool is technically insane and he can see the fourth wall, but we don't know if we're ever told if the fourth wall is real or not. But it is real because
I don't
I
have an
just
answer.
Break
I just...
it down to self-aware or not self-aware.
Yeah.
And Deadpool is self-aware.
Deadpool,
you know,
Deadpool knows he's in a movie and he's Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah.
So
yeah, he knows.
He
he's
knows
Ryan
he's Ryan
Reynolds,
Reynolds
in a
so,
suit
yeah.
in a movie.
But nothing. Reiterate, nothing like that happens in Galaxy.
Not
West.
At all. Yeah,
Tim
yeah.
Allen doesn't know he's Tim Allen.
Right.
He doesn't go. There's no grunts.
He doesn't go from saying never give up, never surrender to infinity
and beyond.
Beyond.
That's right. Exactly. That's right. Kind of amazing to have a career where you have two comedy slogans like that.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Tim Allen did it, man. So yeah, I think
Robin Williams probably has two slogans, but I'll think about that in another episode.
Another one. Let's talk about setups and payoffs. I think that's probably
yeah.
the biggest subject
so,
we have.
So I
right?
didn't list. Because I thought it would be exhaustive and unnecessary, but this has, if you watch this movie and break it down, it has such an efficient setup. It takes 12 minutes, and in 12 minutes, we learn every single possible thing we need to know about every single character, the concept, the world, the problems, even the alien conflict is set up within 10 minutes. The 12 minutes is when he wakes up and they arrive at his house, mm-hmm. but the problem is already... established before that. They're like, we need your help.
Yeah.
That happens
we
in like 9 minutes.
Your help.
The entire movie is set up in 12 minutes. And with all the payoffs that there are, it's crazy how they, you know, it's a great lesson in setup if you watch this first 12 minutes of this movie.
Yeah. And I mean, the way I look at the setup and payoffs in this movie, there's so many things. This is one of those movies, like a Pixar movie, that you could study and learn how to write from, I think.
Yep.
And the one thing I'm always really impressed about this movie when I'm doing my own writing and I'm conceiving a whole three-act structure is a lot of times when I'm conceiving a three-act structure, like imagine I was thinking of this, I might start adding this stuff in the back end. Like instead of what this movie does so well, it brings back the rock monster.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It brings back the lines that they say.
Yeah.
In a lot of my first drafts, I don't do that. I start adding stuff.
Okay.
So like I'll bring a Death Star in on the third act. It'll get bigger and it'll get bigger and it'll get bigger. And I think when you're a really good professional writer and you're singing and you're writing, when you're just letting it sing, this kind of script where you keep calling back, where things that you saw early on that rock, you know, rocked it out of the park.
Yeah. Chekhov's gun.
Yeah.
Pretty
much.
It's right?
Chekhov's gun.
Yeah.
And then you come back, you shoot the gun, and then you do something else. You throw
the gun
at somebody in
yeah.
the head.
Then it turns
the
out the gun is the only thing, the gun that can kill the villain ever. Right. Yeah, right, yeah.
And, you know, that is what Galaxy Quest does so well. Like, Chekhov's gun's one thing, but it's doing, like, three-dimensional chess with Chekhov's gun is what it's doing. And I think that's my favorite lesson, one of my favorite lessons to learn from Galaxy Quest. It does such a good job in so many different areas, not just one spot, but many spots.
Oh, with all the care, it does a great setup payoffs. It has like subplots. It has they're all visual. It has dialogue. There's a ton of dialogue callbacks, not just with the never give up, never surrender. There's tons of dialogue callbacks.
I mean, they grab Thar's hammer
and
everything. That's my favorite moment in the movie is from when his like the what a savings to him legitimately saying it to his biggest fan in the universe.
Yes.
It's like that's such a beautiful moment and it's so well constructed.
And even the first time he says it when it's just a setup of what he said in the show, it's kind of a parody moment. So it's funny, you know, when you see him say it. Then you see him say it when he's so ashamed of it.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious. That's like this great kind of sad, you know, cringy moment. And then when he says it in the end, it's actually tear-jerking. So it's like amazing how... They can pull off all three of those things with one little bit like that.
And they do that over and over.
Over and over.
One thing we haven't talked about much in the podcast that's like a tool that's easy to use. I use this with a lot of my clients who are trying to figure out how to efficiently do a subplot.
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell people, we may differ on this, Jamie. I'm sure you have your own methods of telling a subplot, but I think a subplot needs sort of the same things that an overall story is.
It
kind of has its beginning, middle, and ending.
Yeah, it at least needs three beats.
Yeah, three beats. And so the rule of three.
Like a joke?
Yeah.
Like a joke. Set up, establish, payoff.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, well, there's a lot, sometimes there's reversals in the middle.
Right, sure. I'm trying to boil it down.
Yeah, yeah. So, for instance, there's a lot of those in the movie. You just talked about the Lazarus.
A lot of what?
You have a beginning, middle, and end.
But this is your rule of three. Yeah. I don't know that you said the rule of three.
The rule of three.
We're going to talk about the rule of three. Yes. So that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, which is kind of an extended setup payoff, right? Yeah. It's like one beat.
Comes from Charmed, I think.
Is it?
TV show. No. Yeah, something. Power
the rule of three. Remake or original?
I learned this. That's right. Once you kind of learn it, you'll see it in movies over and over. The audience repetition is like how we like emotionally respond to things. We've seen something and we see it again, and then by the third time we have an expectation about what that is.
That's a joke thing too, like the rule of three. Like if you usually you say something, the second one establishes the pattern, and then the third one's the exaggeration.
Yeah, yeah.
The establish is very important.
The establish is important.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like in Zombieland, you can't just say the Twinkie thing once.
That's right.
You have to say the Twinkie thing twice, and then when he eats the Twinkie, we're...
Right, yeah. Exactly. Right, and it's a reversal of our expectation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's so simple, and it's so easy to do. Yeah. And this movie does... like Laredo has one. Laredo is, it's the pedal to the metal, right? The first time he says pedal to the metal, like he's in the ship and it scrapes the wall and then he can't drive through the minefield. And then the second time, the pedal to the metal, he actually says it all three times. He's watching the video training. He's like, pedal to the metal, real slow and you know, I don't know if I can do this. And then the third time they're like, Laredo, hit it, and he's like, pedal to the metal, you know, like and we've seen it twice, so we respond to it when it's like just a great,
and it's a delicate balance too, because four times doesn't seem right.
Right. Well, the Gravdar's hammer, I wrote it's like a rule of six.
Oh really?
But said like six times, but there's three. I broke down the three main beats as not the even though the What a Savings is my like probably my favorite movie moment in the whole movie, it's actually the funniest moment.
Yeah,
I think it's my favorite.
What a Savings!
It's the you know what? It's the pause. It's the pause before What a Savings.
No, but the big beats for me with that subplot are
Leonard Nimoy could have never said that.
Come on.
God, Alan Rickman makes me miss him so much watching this movie. It's all fan based. Okay, so the first time we actually hear it is not out of his mouth. It's all fans. So he's sitting there, and the fan says it to him, by Gravdar's hammer, blah, and he lows it, right? He like scoffs at it. And he's like, right?
Yeah,
he's so fucking done. And then the second fan moment is when he jumps on the ship and he meets that guy, Qualick, and that guy starts to say it, and he says, don't say it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then the third time is the fan moment where the fan is dying, his greatest fan, really, which he learns
in the universe,
dying.
In the
his
universe.
Greatest fan is, you're like a father to me. And suddenly there it's like dignified and it has meaning.
Yeah. It's when he realizes that his whole career actually was worthwhile.
Right.
That's his arc.
Perfect.
Right.
Yeah. We can talk about that later too.
Yeah, we'll
but like
later.
Those moments for me are the big beats because they're all fan based and they're all like targeted to a specific aspect of his story, which is like, what does what I'm doing mean?
Sure.
You know? And then the Tech Sergeant
kind of playing into the theme there too. Yeah. We're dabbling with that. Okay.
The Tech Sergeant Chen thing, the digital conveyor. It's like there's multiple moments where he says, "I'm not smart enough to do this." Tony Shalhoub, he actually says, "I'm not smart enough." And the Pig Lizard beam fails. That's the first time. The second time, Jason, he beams them up. They succeed, but they're all kind of like, "Oh, I can't believe that happened," right?
Yeah.
But then the third time, it switches. He is smart enough. And he beams up the rock monster intentionally to destroy the militia. So that's like a great rule of three right there. That's three beats. And then the Omega 13 has three main beats. And it's the first time when we're introduced to it, Mathazar says, Saris wants it, and no one in the whole movie knows what it is. Mm-hmm. The second time, Justin Long's character says exactly what it is. They're like, what does it do? We don't know. And Justin Long says, well, we know what it does. We think, you know. And then the third beat, Jamie and I were talking about this off screen, is so simple. He's like, we know what it does. And he presses the button, you know.
Do you ever think about this, you know, we're talking about a script podcast about Galaxy Quest, and it's a movie that's really heavily involved in television writing,
mm-hmm.
obviously, mm-hmm. with the yeah. joke with the chompers and everything. Well, I always thought that another kind of hidden joke in there is the Omega 13, since the show, the fake show ended right before they figured out what the Omega 13 is. Like, there's this weird commentary on fandom.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the fans actually could guess what it was, and then then actual fans out in space made the thing.
Yeah.
And that the
that
fan
was able
theory.
To do it.
No, it's a fan theory that's right.
Right.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Isn't that a weird
thing? And the fans saved the day.
The fans
too.
Saved the day, yeah. And they're with a fan theory. It's like. Really, this I don't know if that's yeah. ever really pulled out of Galaxy Quest. A lot of people don't. I've never heard
point.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. I did write down. I didn't put it on here, but I was like, it's awesome how the fans saved
the
day.
Fans. Well, yeah.
This movie was made right before fandom really took it to the next gear.
This is way before.
And
like,
watching that, it's kind of like
Jedi.
It's hard to remember.
Right.
Watching it, it's hard to go, you know what? When this was made, cosplay was not cool.
Yeah.
All the things that are so heavy and like in movies now.
It's when Star Trek fans were looked at like there
the
was documented the Trekkies. Yeah. They were made yeah. fun of.
They were the weirdos, yeah. and then they kind of were leading the charge. They were ahead of their time
yeah.
in some ways.
They were leading the charge.
It's a revenge of the nerds from now we're watching at a time when the nerds kind of rule the world.
Yeah, yeah.
So
for
it
sure.
doesn't. It holds up. It's yeah. not like it doesn't have like weight anymore. But Star Trek's cool now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is cooler than
it's
it
like, yeah,
be,
it's cooler than
sure.
it used to be. It's yeah. cool. Like Justin Long would be like a cool guy.
No, I know.
You know,
he's
like,
no,
no
longer yeah.
yeah.
His mom and dad are not like looking at each other worried about their son
right,
anymore.
Right. Maybe like he's one of those popular
kids. He fits
kids.
In.
He saw that new J.J. Abrams
he's,
movie.
Yeah, he's got his own YouTube channel now.
Right.
With like a
his
million
Twitch
subscribers.
Talking about his favorite Star Trek episodes.
Yeah.
And
he's
super popular. He's
getting
popular.
Ad revenue now.
Well, I mean, yeah, you want to
yeah,
talk about Ark? I feel like
yeah, yeah.
since we're talking about Justin Long's character, he's the, what did you write? The green emasculated loser fan. He knows it's fake, but obsesses regardless. What's the payoff there? His heroes are real.
You know,
and his obsession has merit.
I was thinking yeah. about the script. I didn't do the breakdown. But remember in the one podcast we talked about the my story can beat up your story, those characters?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah, yeah.
So just a quick thing. There's like hero, villain, doubter, believer, protector, detractor, feeler, thinker. I was thinking the fandom, they're almost the believers in this.
Yeah.
You know, they're the ones that...
Yep.
believe everybody else kind of has their doubts, but they're the ones that always believe from the beginning and they're proven right in the end.
Yeah,
they believe when
that's
it literally had, there's no reason to.
Yeah,
I bet if
and
you
then,
broke it down, everybody had a job that was based on those
yeah yeah
things
I,
that you
I think so
before.
I was doing this in the car on the way over, like I didn't really have it planned, but I think the way it goes, like the doubter might be Alan Rickman, maybe a little bit. He's kind of the doubter in that regard.
Yeah.
He could also be the detractor in some ways.
Yeah.
And then the villain, of course, you know, you have a real villain force.
Yeah.
yeah. The believers kind of are mixed because you could yeah. also see the aliens being the
believers.
Well.
Yeah, they're just as much believers.
They have that role as well. The thinker, kind of the one that's usually scared to enter into things, that likes to think first. I don't know. Maybe
Guy?
Yeah, Guy. Guy would be.
Although Guy could also be argued as possibly a detractor
he could,
even at times.
He could. Yeah. I think you're right, yeah. though. I yeah. think it might be.
It might be Guy, right.
In some ways, the Wesley Crusher guy is kind of like
yeah.
that, too.
He's yeah, a he's scared. A doubter as well.
The
yeah.
feeler. Feelers are usually people that kind of jump into it and don't think too much.
That's Tony Shalhoub.
Tony Shalhoub,
yeah,
obviously.
Shalhoub.
I mean,
yeah,
one
game.
Of the best moments of the movie is like, what's wrong with them? I don't know. Come on. Because he just accepts
yeah,
everything
yeah.
instantly, right?
The protector, which is usually like a mentor character or somebody, I think it's Sigourney in some ways. Like, I think that's why she doesn't arc maybe as much as
she
the rest.
She worries. She's the worrier. She has emotional responses to everybody's things.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But she kind of does see Tim Allen for his positives too.
Yeah.
And you know, there's like, it's not a total, like the other ones I think see him just as a problem.
Yeah.
But I think she kind of sees the good in it.
The movie puts
the movie has a really small but effective love story.
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
And it's not even like the I don't think it's the payoff.
Oh, let's talk about this.
The big payoff is not that they fall in love. It's just like this it's like in the background so far, right, but it's really satisfying.
It is. It's very satisfying. Yeah. I want to talk to you about how you and I differ about.
Oh, the arc.
I'm going to referee.
Yeah. How?
Why? I'm not that angry about it.
I think Gwen is a weak character. I think she's the. I think the one thing, time does not. I don't think the female representation in this movie is great.
But I think that's a reflection of what
of the time. Exactly.
No, I'm saying it's a reflection of the source material.
That's true. It's
reflecting the source material.
That's
completely.
Good point. That's a good point.
She's a voluptuous woman and she has one job on the ship.
Right.
And I would argue that her arc in the end was her job in the end was important.
Okay.
She learns that. She feels validated by the end of the movie.
I think that's a good point.
You know,
that's a good
she has
point.
One job on the ship. And she's gonna.
You're
fucking
saying
go.
You're saying at the start of the story, she's not. She doesn't feel like her role in the show mattered.
If you ask these characters now, I'm just assuming the writer here. If you ask these characters before they went up in this space, I think Gwen would have been like, yeah, like you know, Alan Rickman hates this job, but his character was important. Mine was bullshit, and I always knew it was bullshit.
Right.
Okay.
And she knew that her character was sexualized crap.
Okay.
And I think walking off of that ship at the end, she feels like she is actually part of the crew, and she has a function.
That's like a value arc. Okay.
Which
I
bet
have
they
value to others. I didn't see it that way, but when you say
I think,
it,
yeah, it's a
I
value play.
Right.
It's
yeah,
a value play.
I have value to others. Value to others.
I think if you look behind the scenes on that, there might be a bad message in there.
Validating what she was doing.
Not to get into that side of it, because it's a fun movie. And
it's fun.
But maybe that's what you're reacting to a little bit. The thing that's reaffirmed to her is like she did have a positive value.
Well, can I throw something out there too?
Yeah. You say it.
Can I throw something out there? Yeah. It's like when they show the new opening of the new show, The Next Generation, Galaxy Quest, The New Adventures.
Yep.
She's actually wearing a shirt that's covering up her cleavage.
I did. That's very intentional.
And I would assume that show would be much more forwardly thinking written in her character.
It's a good point.
Something we're never going to see.
Yeah. She's
but
not a Barbie doll anymore.
The shirt was just a small thing that was like, okay, now she's going to have an actual function on this ship with the writing and everything.
Right.
She's also the character that criticizes the writing.
That's a good point.
She
says it out
loud.
She is
that character that was
whoever wrote this show needs to die.
Right. No, I mean, and she has the most right to be as angry because her character is like a 60s television show was sexualized.
Yeah.
And she had the shitty end of the stick with among everyone.
Good call.
It's a small arc, Jimmy. I'm not saying it's the greatest. It's definitely the least effective one.
Yeah.
But it's there.
I think you're right.
The love story arc sometimes that is in movies like this that aren't really about love stories. They tend to be like mentor arcs or something, you know, they're almost there for better or worse. They're there to help the main hero arc as opposed to for them to arc themselves.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of going on here a little bit.
Like she's there as a function for Tim Allen.
To help him grow. It is bad.
But it's a function of the source material though. That's how the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a commentary on like the source material. Yeah.
Right.
But looking back on it compared to like where we are now, it's the one thing that I wish this movie was better about. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what do you think the other arcs are?
Well,
what's Guy's arc?
It's
easy.
Yeah.
He says it out loud.
No,
he says, he's like, if I'm gonna die, I'm gonna die with honor. Because
accepting his fate.
Yeah, he's selfish the entire time. Like every single scene is about him. In the movie, he's like, I'm gonna die, there's something grabbed me, and they're nothing grabbed you, dude.
Right.
I would say it's desperate, then selfish, then
self-realized. But his laugh, his last moment of his last big, you know, moment to shine, he grabs a gun, he's like, I don't care if I'm gonna die,
we're introduced to him as desperate, though.
Yeah,
like he'll do anything to be a part of this crew, right? Yeah,
I love him.
He's the best.
It's interesting because they all have slightly different arcs.
I know.
You know, so it's hard to tie them all into one. Like like what the wording is for the one arc that they all have.
Overall arc?
Yeah. Is it fakers become makers? Or is it, I don't know what exactly it is. Because you have Tim Allen, who's a guy.
Isn't this theme? Isn't this kind of playing into the
this
theme?
This is playing into the theme.
Yeah.
But you have Tim Allen's arc, who is kind of a guy who isn't a leader. He's selfish and he needs to become less. Again, we go to our, what are our top three arcs?
We need to know these by now. Our three arcs.
Number one, to care more.
Care more.
Number two is to be more confident.
Be more confident.
And number three, the addendum, is to work well as a team.
Work as a team.
They're almost all there.
Yeah, they are.
That's the weird thing about
this. It's pretty textbook.
Yeah. I mean. All of those are here.
I think he's got the standard captain arc, which is accept that he can't do it alone.
Right.
And then he has faults.
You got to pass the ball sometimes.
Right. And he says, I'm in the beginning of the movie, it's so well, and this is probably not in the writing, this is in the directing, but it's visual, so it's there. He's sitting at a table alone by himself, and there, at a completely separate section, giving their own autographs, he's by himself, and he's like, I'm not a commander without my crew.
Right.
And they're all looking at him with disdain, so he totally doesn't believe it. And by the end, he embodies that, you know?
So the teamwork thing is definitely the thing that's hit the heaviest.
Yeah.
You know, he's taking gigs that they don't get. Yeah, things like that.
Exactly.
Some of the things that throw it into the mix, that throw it weird, though, is when he's in the bathroom and the guys are like, did you see those losers?
It's weird. It's like a mini Dark Knight of the Soul for a moment.
Yeah.
Right.
It is.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. Yeah. He has his own. I there's nowhere on the outline of this to talk about this, but one of my favorite scenes in the movie is that he and Justin Long in that early scene where he blows up at Justin Long, he was just in the bathroom experiencing the reality of his fantasy,
mm-hmm.
you know, being told that he's not a star, like he is a has-been, you know, this fandom is not real, it's only for these people, everybody else looks at him as a joke.
Right.
And then the very next scene he does the exact same thing to Justin Long, and you know, that guy's fantasy is thrown in his face, it's not a reality, it is a joke.
Right.
I just thought that was so brilliant, and I didn't remember the juxtaposition being so
then it's 85 minutes of proving him wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, no, it really, yeah, yeah. It's
just such great writing, you know, look in the mirror. Yeah.
But it's interesting because he has those things. He has these self-worth kind of things that he has to get over. But then he also has the teamwork thing. That's the
right
thing. So I guess the path to his self-worth recovering is through the team.
Right.
In some ways. But then you have a character like Alan Rickman's character who, it very much is the same thing. If you read Spock's or Leonard Nimoy's biographies, you know, he basically resented kind of the role, or not resented it, but you know, he didn't really think it mattered much and things like that. And then later on, when he realized how he inspired people to, you know, become astronauts,
actual science.
That's what touched him and made him, you know, relook at the importance of playing Spock and things like that. And that's kind of what Rickman's role.
This movie does that in 90 minutes instead of 80 years.
Exactly. I called it a dignity arc. Like, there's no dignity to what I'm doing. And then by the end, it's very dignified. He feels dignified.
Right. Which is very, and this is why, in some ways, the theme part, I have a hard time. That's different than a guy that needs to learn he's arrogant and be part of the team.
Yeah, that's not at all.
They're not
his
very
is,
much
yeah.
the same.
I would argue that there's about 3 to 4 themes, actually, in this movie.
That's
and
I mean.
That's why it's a really good movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does more than one job.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, you could easily write.
It's funny
write
when you say how the arcs, because you're right. The arcs usually kind of all line.
The arcs
up.
Are
all
themes. The arcs
They're
are kind of themes.
Own.
That's usually the way
it
is.
Yeah.
So that's why I was having a tricky time isolating one.
Something we didn't say. Maybe this is a function of a great ensemble movie.
Mm-hmm.
Every character is the protagonist, technically,
and
every character
story.
Has their own theme.
Yeah, and it works really well.
So, you know, a great ensemble works, maybe functions as 5 or 6 small movies.
Yeah.
Right?
That's definitely true, but in the case of something like The Incredibles, you can kind of tie them into
a unifying
overall thing.
Usually.
I'm not sure
they're also
it
a family.
Is.
This was not a family. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Now, in this case, we probably could. We just have to do some verbal gymnastics.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We have
to
apply something.
I think
that
there's multiples. Yeah.
How about, here's one, though, and I didn't think about this at all, so this is a stumper. Does Saris inform the theme at all? What's his goals?
I think he's
more a function of the plot.
I don't know, man.
Really? Yeah, okay.
He almost seems like because all of his stuff is mocking the aliens,
mm-hmm.
the fans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I almost feel like he's a commentary on fan haters, like fanboy haters, even when they're like that. Explain to him as if he were a child.
He's those two kids in the bathroom.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
he is. That you said it perfectly. He's making fun of like the things that they believe in, you know, and the things that they put their faith in and that they put their passions into. Like it's very deliberate in that speech.
He is. He's a cold, dead warrior.
Yeah,
that knows nothing but the
he's
fight.
He's lost his sense of imagination.
Yeah, no, he has a heart. He has no heart to his character, and that's the point.
So I think
he fights because it is a fight, right?
And that's the other thing. Then even talking about the arcs, then there's this bigger picture on fandom and the importance and why fandom, why it isn't get a life, that they have a life. There's all that kind of stuff wrapped up into it too. And how does so then you have to put all these things on
how
a wall
tie
and
in?
Tie it all into one big
like Justin Long and his friends, like what what's the moral premise of them?
Right.
What you have to get all their moral premises
one
and
day
then
it'll pay
them.
Off, guys. Like is that a dangerous thing to say too? Know, like your obsession, will that pay off?
Well, they never give up, never surrender themselves, you know.
And then you have things like never give up, never surrender, and that's usually a key to the theme. Yeah. Is it a key to the theme?
I don't think so.
It kind
of
has a lesser implication, but it
I think you're I think when you were saying the fake it till you make it, I think authenticity is really the core one. But it's weird because all of those arcs we just discussed don't line up with authenticity. Mm-hmm. These characters don't have authenticity issues, and yet the movie really is about
But it
like,
ends with them being authentically
who they are. That's
heroes.
A good point.
Like, by the end they are who they are.
They become not, the characters they played.
From the moment they land, they are no longer acting.
There's a part of me, not that this bothers me in the movie, it's not a criticism, but there's a part of me like,
take
is
it
that,
down, Jamie
is
Burnett.
That really an authenticity is to become the character? Like, I think the real thing for Kirk, for William Shatner to learn is he's not Captain Kirk. And he's okay with that.
And he should be okay with that. You're saying, like, in reality, that's a way healthier way to tell
right.
the story.
Instead, they learn that they are the
they
characters
are,
they portray.
He is Commander? Yeah.
It's not a
problem.
It's
almost like a wish fulfillment.
And that's fine. That's the way the movie's set up.
It works very well. But I agree with you.
So
it's kind of messy.
Serendipitously, I watched this, like, last week because we rescheduled our recording.
Yeah.
But you know what I watched 2 days ago that made me think of this movie? Which was Bruce Almighty.
Oh.
Which is a weird thing. And it's only because of one Morgan Freeman quote in that where he was like, where he says, you know, is a courageous person courageous, or is it because they had the opportunity to be courageous?
Interesting.
Which made me think of Galaxy Quest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It made me think of everything, like this movie, you know what I mean? Like they were.
Yeah.
They rose to the occasion. They rose to the occasion. They necessarily weren't. They would never have gone out and sought it themselves.
Absolutely not.
They had to be given the opportunity.
Yeah.
To
there's
do
a
it.
Great refusal of the call moment when all of them are simultaneously running away from the situation after they see the aliens and everything. It's like such a
right.
I like said it out loud. That's a hell of a refusal of the call. I want to talk about the blind obsession.
Yep.
Did you make that note, or did you
I think
make
that's a
Jamie
note? One.
Yeah.
Any terms, just, Jamie's going to do one.
Well, just because the last time you brought up the blind obsession, which I think was Bridesmaids, I was kind of fascinated by it, so I wanted to see if you could do it.
I was too. Dude. I've never heard of that.
Yeah,
so.
I really, it's become a new thing, like when I'm thinking about comedy in my head.
What? It made me think of Weird Al. All of his songs are about blind obsessions.
That's a good point.
If you think about
it. I never really thought of that. Yeah.
All of his songs are about a human being who is absolutely insane for something. Think about it.
And the comedy around that song is about the obsession.
Yeah. Everything.
Fascinating.
Their whole existence is about one
Remember,
thing.
They can have more than one. So that's what's cool.
Hence why it's... He's doing songs. You're talking about.
Because I'm learning that too. Like now I'm going into like the comedies, really like looking at that and being like, wow, it does work. So... It works really well in this
slightly
movie.
Redefine
okay, so
what it is.
So Robert McKee,
we're
bringing up
our
again.
it's okay.
Jesus
it's
Christ.
Okay.
One day Brian Cox will be on the podcast.
God fucking.
Adaptation.
He did not pay us, so we don't completely adhere to all his stuff. Just works sometimes.
Charlie Kaufman convinced us that.
Right.
Read the book.
Robert McKee says that in comedies, the comedy is often based around a character's blind obsession. So, like, all the comedy related to that character will be specifically about some aspect of their character that's an obsession that they're not aware of, or sometimes aware of, Gwen's...
What's a good example in another movie that isn't this? Would it be like Ace Ventura being obsessed with animals?
Yeah, that's perfect. And like so much of the comic, but he has like three or four, but one of them is about his animals.
Absolute obsession with animals.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, Gwen's is really simple and it is used for comedy over and over. And that is that I have one job on this ship. It's stupid, but I'm going to do it. And so over and over, there's constant comedic situations brought about by the fact that she's going to say what the computer says no matter what.
She's diehard.
It's a comic obsession, right? She's obsessed with it. Like, and then Tony Shalhoub. It's not really that defined, but it is consistent, and that is that he is wowed, entertained, and game for anything this situation brings him. In every scene, he's like, that was a hell of a thing.
Except if it'll harm somebody.
That's the only time
he doubts himself.
That's a good point. It's more about him. But situation after situation, when they're flying onto the ship, like... he's like really excited about the fact that they're landing up when they see the little kids and everything, like he's really excited about these little aliens. Everybody else is freaking out. Over and over, it's about him being excited about this stuff.
He kind of, for me, he's very reminiscent of Rey from Ghostbusters.
I thought Rey from The Last Jedi.
Man, we keep bringing up The Last Jedi.
Jamie likes to bring that up.
I think it's because you want to troll people with The Last Jedi, right?
Just remind them constantly.
Ray is a great example. He loves that. Guy, he's convinced he's going to die in every scene. He's like, I don't even have a last name, man. Like, all the comedy is based around him wanting to, like, thinking he's certain to.
Which is such an illogical thing. I love it in the movie. Is like, dude, yes, they made the ship real and they made all the technology, but the writing of the actual situations isn't something they can replicate.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you could live, you know what I mean?
Yeah. But he's obsessed that he's the guy in the show that gets killed. Laredo's the comic obsession is that like he's the only pilot that any of the ships will allow to fly, but he can't fly.
Right.
And all the comedy is based around the fact like I can't fly, like I don't know how to do this, you know. So it's over and over. Jason has two, and that I think these are his comics, and that is nothing's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Like over and over, it's no big deal. The only thing that he takes serious and the comedy is based around this is the role. Like nothing else. He takes nothing else serious except being Commander Taggart, right? And then over and over, the story brings him situations where he's like, it's not a big deal. I'm the commander, you know? And then the second one is sort of similar, but he always has to be the hero. In every scene, he's got to be the hero. And like all of the comedy and the situation is about, I can do this. I'm the hero, you know? And then.
See, you got your shirt off.
I see you got your shirt off.
Right.
Yeah. And I love that he's not like a big ripped guy like that.
He's like William Shatner. Yeah.
Exactly. I love that.
Yeah.
Alan Rickman has two. And that is he's a theatrically trained actor that is too good for any of this, right? Mm-hmm. It's all beneath him. Every moment, this is beneath me. This is beneath me. This is beneath. I'm a fat. And they say it over and over. Five curtain calls? You know, they.
Right.
And then the second one, I don't know if this is a comic obsession, but it's something I noticed that I didn't think about before. There's comedy over and over about the fact that he has to maintain his cover. As an alien, he has to maintain. He's the only character who has
a head point.
Yeah, he has to maintain the fact that he is an alien. So there's one comedic situation, like his food, his living quarters, all this shit about the fact that he has to not tell anybody that he's not an alien, right?
And do you think the validation of him and his you know like his saying his arc and everything?
Yeah.
It's also kind of a validation of the actual material to him.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like the act, he's like in the end, it's not just my character was important. He's got to probably be like Galaxy Quest as a TV show is great work.
Mattered.
Right,
it's great work and it mattered. And it
mattered.
I mean, we don't get that, but he has to come to that conclusion.
Yeah,
right?
I agree. Yeah, completely.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's fine.
I think in that scene where he says that to the his dying fan, so to speak, that's where he realizes it matters as well, or just how much it matters.
Like, I mean,
this is comfort on somebody's deathbed is almost a thing, and his revenging for them is important. You know?
Yeah, it holds it holds weight where it didn't before. Yeah, I mean, there's a literal
it's equal to Hamlet or whatever.
Yeah. I honestly think his character magnitude. Makes the movie great.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I think it's what it takes it from okay to great.
I think because it is based in that Spock reality, I think that's where they were able to really dig in and come up with a really unique and interesting
character. It's funny. I didn't know that Spock stuff that it informed the story, and knowing that, I like it that much more, you know.
And Shatner never... You know what I mean? Shatner probably still is like at the beginning of Galaxy Quest, and he'll die at the beginning of Galaxy Quest.
Right.
Because he's William Shatner. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas Spock died at the end of Galaxy Quest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
That's right.
Yeah. Poignant.
But
sorry, Jimmy.
No, it's fine. And then there's the Mathazar and Justin Long essentially have the same comic obsession, which is that the show is real. The show is real. The show is real. And all the comedy in those characters is based around that obsession that the show is real. So McKee's rule for comic obsession works really well with this movie. So two movies in a row that were comedies, it lines up perfectly.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
It's good learning. You got a character.
Yeah, can I bring up something too that is a moment where I feel like it's very I don't know if it's as much of a writing thing, but the moment when Mathazar ask why.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that from a writing standpoint is incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like this movie is such a silly movie and it's such a pointed movie to Star Trek, but literally I don't know if I've ever seen a movie that questioned why we make all this crap better than Galaxy Quest.
Yeah. No, it's
you know what
call.
I mean? Like the whole structure of you know the aliens and all this, and they're like, well, why
does
would
any
you
of this matter?
Why would you make a TV show?
Yeah.
That does that. You know,
in some ways
fiction.
In some ways though, that might be the thing that ties all these themes together.
It might be,
because now you can tie that with Saris's, you know, he's on the other side of the why. He's like, why do you do that? Stupid.
This is
Saris knows
explain.
What it is though.
Yeah.
I love that Saris is aware of what a TV show is the second he sees it.
Right.
Yeah.
He's never seen special effects in the ship before. How does he know? Yeah. You know,
and then the Thermians are like children. You know, they might need to find out one day that Santa Claus isn't real.
Yeah.
Why would you even lie about that?
Why would you make up Santa in the first place?
And the other ones are adults dealing in these children's worlds, so to speak. They are dealing with fandom, which is like children. It's us wanting to be children again and have that sense of wonder and fascination. And they're wondering, they've had these careers based on pretending and playing. And that's where all their self-doubts come from is, you know, Hamlet's important, but Star Trek isn't and stuff like that. So in some ways, there's probably, if we did the verbal gymnastics to find a moral premise, there's probably a way to tie everybody into that, you know, why for Star Trek.
I'm really happy I said that.
Yeah,
it's a perfect segue, Bob.
I
think so.
I'm not sure. I don't know what the theme of this movie is. I couldn't tie it. I tried.
I think it has several, but the why now, maybe I didn't even think about my own statement. Maybe
I'm sure if we had another hour to spend on talking about it, we could figure out a way that the why connects to all those things.
So Mathazar
just
said
seems like
something.
Such an important scene. It's such
why. Yeah,
he's being tortured. It holds so much emotional weight, and it's just like it feels like he's asking you.
And why did we? And Tim Allen says it's difficult to explain.
Right.
But Mathazar said something, and I didn't find an answer in this, but I thought that this kind of could lead to an answer. He says when he first meets them, about the historical documents, we enjoyed watching you display courage, teamwork, and build friendships through adversity. And that's like what the movie is about, right? Mm-hmm. But what is that thematic statement, you know?
Yeah.
That's the experience of watching this movie is we watch them display courage, teamwork, and build friendships through adversity. So it was very on the nose, but he says it in like 10 minutes into the movie. I'm not sure
and
what
if
that
you,
says.
But if you go back to like Star Trek and Gene Roddenberry and stuff like that, that's where they would have you believe, you know, was the greater impact of Star Trek. You know, it was back in the 1960s and everybody was at peace with each other.
Yeah.
And racism didn't exist. And this optimistic hopeful future.
You're saying in the show.
In the actual Gene Roddenberry show.
Compared to what was going on in the real
the
world.
Why, in some ways, I'm sure they would probably say, this is why Star Trek endures.
Progress.
Yeah. And I think...
Social progress.
Social progress, optimism, hope for a better future.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling that that's sort of what the Galaxy Quest people, the Thermians, saw this thing. They're being attacked by, you know, this bully. And they see a hope for a better future where friendship and optimism and stuff like that permeates.
Also, I mean, facts, science, you know, the things that they already know and hold up. And they see a hero embracing that thing, too.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a good point that you said, though, because Sirius wants to eliminate their race.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he wants to, he has no imagination.
Right. He's a genocidal maniac.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's... He's really an incredibly terrible villain.
Yeah, he's great.
And it's like, and he looks, you know, he's like in this silly movie, but it's really dark.
One thing, you know, Galaxy Quest came along early in my writing days. And one of the things of many that I took from it was the villain character. When I started to write comedies, I realized that it's almost better to have a scary villain in your comedy. Like somebody that's really kind of scary and kind of frightening and kind of ruthless in your comedy to play against the heroes.
Can I point one of the greatest?
Yeah.
Biff Tannen.
Biff.
Yeah.
You know, Biff, Back to the Future is written so perfectly.
Yeah, eventually we'll do it on this one.
We'll eventually do it. And I'll say it right now. Like, you know, Back to the Future comes off as like this PG comedy that's like light and science fiction with great characters. But Biff Tannen is a murderer. Rapist.
He's trying to rape her, which
it's like when you grow up, you don't realize that. And then you realize Biff Tannen is one of the worst villains in movie history.
This movie has a lot in common with Back to the Future in that it sort of goes to all these different genres and has payoffs in many different levels. Mm-hmm. It's not just comedy. It's not just action. It's not just sci-fi. Yeah. And it's this weird movie that doesn't happen. It's surprising that it doesn't happen more often because whenever it does, it's instant classic.
Yeah.
Like when they get it all to work.
It's all cylinders, man.
It's all cylinders.
I said over and over watching this the other night, I just kept saying, movie magic.
Yeah. I mean, like, can you
it's
think?
It's lightning in a bottle. Yeah. You can't replicate this.
It only comes around once every now and then. Like I always say that these are the kind of movies I want to write.
Yeah, me too.
But it's easier said than done.
Yeah, of course.
With movies of this, like, with movies of this genre and tone, I usually think you can only have one or two a decade.
Maybe.
For me, like, in the 90s, it was this and Men in Black, I would say. And then there's, like, Ghostbusters, if you
when
go back.
When did Men in Black come out in
Men in Black was 98?
Couple years 98? Before this, right?
Yeah.
Because it feels, it's very,
which is also written by, like Ed Solomon. Yeah. You got your Bill and Ted writers and stuff.
I think,
you know?
Robert Gordon, if I'm not mistaken, might have done Men in Black 2, you know, so he was involved in
this
that.
This feels on.
The worst Men in Black movie, but right.
It feels in line with that movie. I was watching this feeling
Can't you put all like movies like this kind of side by side and like the good ones really stand out?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and sometimes they're unfairly kind of maligned.
You can barely remember.
I like Evolution a lot. I'm a big fan of Evolution. I kind of.
Yeah, it's kind of okay.
It's kind of okay.
I'm with Jamie.
It's okay.
But I know that's
it. It was a great failure.
Evolution is the one I would point out is like trying to be these ones, but you know.
Something didn't stick.
Something about it didn't stick.
It's a lesser Ghostbusters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't try these kind of movies too often either.
No, I know.
I think because they are so hard to pull off.
Yeah.
They want something specific, you know?
Yeah. This movie did it.
It would take me a day to think of like closer examples to now.
Yeah.
To the 2018.
Yeah. Well.
Like.
Yeah.
With like a PG-13 or less.
No, I can't.
Supernatural sci-fi comedy.
Nothing touches this, man. Nothing.
Yeah, nothing. Really? It is a high mark.
Yeah. That's
why we're talking about
it. That's why we're talking about it.
I still, though, it's funny that we can't work out the theme. Because there's too many, like you said.
But I think us not being able to work out the theme is like a product of it being so well written.
It can say so many
I don't think
things.
It's a problem with it.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
It's there. I just can't put my words
Me
around
neither.
It or my brain around it.
Me neither.
I find that true a lot of... like the early Spielberg movies too, I have a difficulty just labeling the theme and slapping it down because they kind of are trying to go in a few different directions. And I don't think
it's like
the
it's
writers.
Like everything
it doesn't,
the,
yeah, yeah, it wasn't, you know, it's us trying to extrapolate
trying
stuff
to extrapolate.
That was, yeah.
You guys too, me also, we're kind of doing this after like decades of it kind of becoming a product.
Right.
We look back on it and see the math. Yeah. Whereas right. they were just making the math.
Right. Yeah.
they were like literally constructing it.
Yeah.
Then,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So they probably
they might not have a thematic statement.
No,
in mind. A lot of people don't. But
I have a affinity for these ensemble movies that have arcs for each of the characters.
Me too.
It's not often done very well. Mm-mm. It's usually done very on the nose. Usually one or two characters don't really get a very good shake at it.
Yeah.
But this one really does it well.
Yeah. It feels effortless.
Mm-hmm.
It's very very smooth. Yeah,
I'd put this one right up there, like teaching scripts with The Incredibles.
Yep,
like
agreed.
To me, the two are like neck and neck for if you want to learn how to do this, study these two.
Yeah,
and
it's funny too because we just spent all this time talking about how we can't figure out the theme. You're like, study it.
Yeah. We'll study it. We'll study it for the mechanics. It's got structure, like, the great mechanics. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Especially the setup. That first 12 minutes is you learn everything.
Yep.
It's so efficient.
I hate to ask, what's the lesson? Have we already stated what the lesson was?
Yeah, I think we've stated a gazillion
tons of lessons.
A lot of lessons.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the lesson I take away from this? Yeah, I probably did just state it with the ensemble thing. I mean, there's no better movie for me that I would watch except this one for ensemble character arcs.
And how each of them has their own little mini story.
Yeah. There's so many lessons.
Very efficiently. Yeah.
And it's honestly one that this movie is one that's influenced my screenwriting. It came at a time when I started screenwriting and I started to pay attention to this stuff. And it's one that I reference when I break story myself. So
I actually didn't know that was that close to your heart, Jamie.
Yeah,
I didn't
either.
I didn't know.
Aww.
Hey.
Yeah, man, you got anything else to say about it now that we know?
No.
That was it.
Do you have any lesson, Jimmy?
I don't want to watch the television show. I'm not really interested in an ongoing story about these people.
I think
there's a television show
that's in
development?
It's in development, Amazon. Which
doesn't
seem like this is a television show.
It won't be them,
though.
Yeah. I can
even worse.
I can disregard it if it's
so
not
mad
them.
About that.
I mean,
I don't know why.
It could even be the Orville at the end of the day.
I like the Orville.
No, I agree. But
do we
need the Orville?
No.
Based on Galaxy Quest? No.
No, because the Orville is pretty much Galaxy Quest.
It's
was a show.
Its own thing.
Yeah. Yep. Right.
The lesson I learned. I mean, I learned something about the movie that Gwen does have an arc. And
wow, I changed your mind a little bit.
She has value. It's a value to others arc. That's a very common arc. Like, I have no value to others, too. I have value to others. And it's also very common in a team movie.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a team movie. So that totally makes sense. When you said it, explained it,
okay.
I can see it. I agree. I was wrong.
Oh, wow. I didn't expect all of that. But, okay.
Wow.
Well, I learned that I think maybe more so than ever that a well-written movie might not be able to, you can't put your finger on it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Like, I consider this like a perfect, big budget studio comedy.
Yeah.
And
Hollywood done best.
I feel like it's funny that all three of us couldn't put our finger on what it's about exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of just
never
about
give up, never surrender.
Right. Well, no, it's it's kind of about a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it is.
And it's harmony. It's harmony with like five themes. Yeah. That's it. Really?
Yep. I agree.
I agree.
You guys good? Okay. That's the end of Galaxy Quest. Jamie's favorite movie. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
It's up there. At least as far as screenwriting instructive references.
Very instructive.
If you asked me the question, and I've been asked this question, if you could write one movie, I always say it would be like Galaxy Quest. I bring it up a lot in conversation.
And I say Back to the Future, and they're very similar.
Back to the Future would be a similar.
You know what
I would say?
Wayne's World.
That's so fitting, Bob. It's awesome.
It's funny that we're all say comedies. Okay.
Yeah.
That's really funny, yet we don't talk about comedies.
No, we don't. We can talk about more.
That's
maybe
fine.
We will.
All right, guys. This was great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've just listened to Writer's Blockbusters, a screenwriting podcast featuring two professionals and another guy. Available only on Thundergrunt.